Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Monday, November 24th, Joe was joined by Professor of Political Science at Hartwick College in Oneonta and Co-Director of the Institute of Public Service, Laurel Elder, Preceptor in Public Speaking, Strategic Communications, and Public Relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, Political Consultant and Lobbyist, Libby Post, and Professor of Government at Dutchess Community College and President of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Rydell.
I'm going to sort of go backwards because of how the weekend folded out, but Marjorie Taylor Greene, okay, that was a shocker when that happened on Friday night. Didn't expect that.
Nope.
We had many of us who are news hounds were watching President Trump and the mayor-elect of New York City, Zoran Mamdani, together and seem to have what the cable channels way too often refer to as a bro fest.
I would say thinking of it as a bromance, but that's okay.
Okay, whatever.
Right.
The two of them seemed to get along. It was very warm. It was, I think in our national politics now, when two people actually are cordial, it's a major thing.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was incredible.
That's so true.
And then you have this person who he called a socialist, and Mamdani called Trump a fascist, and they're getting along. And then the person who was at the, you know, wore all the red hats and came to the mm-hmm. State of the Union addresses and got
and
up and screamed and yelled
Biden,
and
right.
Well, now she said, I'm done. I'm out. I will be out as of January 5th. And it was a shock resignation. It surprised just about everyone. And if you watch the video announcement, which was posted Friday night, 11 minutes long, and it went viral, and it was really just a laundry list of policy and political disagreements with Trump, with the Republican Party, with Speaker Mike Johnson, and she positioned herself as the true MAGA champion and declared that if she had been cast aside, then many common Americans have been cast aside and replaced as well. Laurel, I didn't see this one coming.
I didn't either. I know this is an incredible story for so many reasons. I feel like I could talk about it for an hour and a half, but I'm not going to do that. I'll just lay out a couple reasons why I think it's really, you know, fascinating, and then maybe we can circle back to some of the others. But I mean, first of all, here is, you know, there's 435 members of Congress. Most people can't name any of them, and even their own representative in many cases. But most people know Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's been on this national scene for a short time, but she is super well known. I mean, she's OG MAGA. Like, she's been there from the beginning, and all of a sudden, here she is. It's been building for a while, but she's taking this great. I mean, we know the drill, as you said, you know, it's like make America great again supporters. They support Trump, whatever he does. They find a way to justify whatever he says. And she took that whole script and she threw it out the window. She challenged Trump not just on the Epstein files, but on the government shutdown, on healthcare subsidies, on U.S. approach to Israel. And so it's just like it's jaw dropping. And now she's talking about we should be more civil in politics. And she's sorry for the role she played in our toxic politics. So it's just the, you know, it reminds us that I guess people can evolve, and it's kind of jaw-dropping. It's also, I'm sure we'll talk about this more, really a window into some of the tensions within the Republican Party, and it opens this question of, like, what is the Republican Party and what is the MAGA movement beyond Trump? Once he's no longer on the political stage or no longer commanding all the power, where does the future of the Republican Party lie? And then, of course, I'm someone who studies gender and politics. So this gets a lot less attention in the news media. But I think this whole situation really underscores the Republican Party's really significant problem with women. And by that, I mean there are very few women Republicans in Congress. Less than 15% of the Republicans in Congress are women. That number hasn't increased in over three decades. And what that means on a practical level is that on a lot of committees and when a lot of important decisions are being made and priorities, there is maybe one or maybe no women part of the Republican Party discussions on these issues. And, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene's experience, I think, and deciding to drop out mid-session is not going to help that problem.
We've seen several graphics in the New York Times, and I point to them just because I've noticed that. And I know other sources have done it, but there'll be a chart of the people who have left the administration, let's say, have the generals and the military leaders who have been cast aside, women, mm-hmm. blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go to who has been cast aside in various departments in the FBI, in the Treasury Department, and you know, and you can go down the list, and it's women and women of color, mm-hmm. I would say.
And then you look at the professions that have just been deprofessionalized, like nursing, right?
Yes.
It's no longer considered a profession, which is
or
such
architects, for God's sake.
Yeah, it's just such bull. I mean, it really, really is. It goes to Trump's "I love the uneducated" ethos. But, you know, when you do nursing is dominated by women, a lot of women of color, and you'll see those folks running for office, maybe not for Congress, but for other things. But I do want to do a footnote here in terms of the MAGA women who do run, Moms for Liberty, is that what they're mm-hmm. called, right? They ran a bunch of people for school boards across the country, and they all lost. Because the book banning and going after trans kids and all that sort of stuff just isn't selling when people can't afford the basics of feeding their children, of being able to go to the doctor.
Yeah, I mean, that said, I mean, there are literally millions of highly qualified conservative women out there who could be running. If I was I'm not a Republican consultant, but if I were, I would be trying to recruit these women and getting them to run. I mean, over 40% of women voted for Trump. And I just think, one, for optics sake, I mean, how long can the Republican Party be out there as a party that's 85% white male in our growing, you know, diverse society? But I also think it has real implications for the agenda of the party and the policies they craft. And I think the Epstein situation sort of illustrates this. So, of course, only four Republicans joined with all the Democrats to vote to, you know, on the discharge petition to have a full vote on making the Epstein files public. And three of those four Republicans were women.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the point is that women and men still, they walk through the world. They have different experiences in the aggregate. And they bring those different experiences to the table. I mean, one of them spoke about her own experience as a teenager being sexually assaulted and why that motivated her, Nancy Mace. And so, you know, it's just having women in the Republican Party, I think, makes it a better party. And so, yeah, I think it's a problem how women have been, you know, treated in the Republican Party overall.
I agreed. I agreed that for me, when I see the very low numbers of women in Congress, first and foremost, it raises red flags. What stands in the way of women mm-hmm. running, of being women being elected? I think that's a problem that across the board. It's also true for the Democratic Party. I think the last time I checked, about 22% of members of Congress, both the Senate and the House, were women, and it has actually gone up a little bit, and I think that's mostly because of the Democratic Party, but it's low, right? But to me, mostly the numbers, when they're this low, it raises red flags. What keeps them from running? What keeps mm-hmm. them from winning elections? Now, in terms of the policy impact, it's certainly any kind of diversity changes the dynamics, without a doubt. But I'm actually going to shy away from looking at Marjorie Taylor Greene as a necessary component in our national political discussion. I mean, she stepped down because she would have faced an upward battle in a very red district against a candidate who would have been endorsed by Trump. I'm not sure whether she was targeted because she's a woman, right? It's to me the discussion here is more interesting in that is, as you said, it illustrates the You know, it's, we, our political party system is truly unique compared to other democracies, because our political parties are not parties per se. They're not institutions, top-down institutions, as there are in other countries. They are movements. And so both Democratic Party and Republican Party see this fluctuation of debates within the political parties rather than outside. And so we're seeing right now where the Republican Party is going. And what I'm seeing is that we're not moving away from the MAGA approach. We're defining what MAGA means. And there isn't that much, I don't see much, but where I see the crux of the debate is, are we going to be more hawkish in foreign affairs? But we're not going to move away from our immigration policies and a reduction in social services and focus on decreasing taxes. So I don't really see an opening. I'm not optimistic that this opens up a possibilities for a more inclusive political party, Republican Party. The question is, what is MAGA going to look like in the future? And that's the extent of it.
Terry Gibson.
Well, I'm just really torn on sort of which way to go on this. I see it sort of two different ways, and I feel like we're sort of missing some information. I've been around politics too long to not be somewhat skeptical of what I'm hearing. I watched the entire video, and I wonder if they have something on her that she is afraid might be revealed if she has to go through this bloody primary, and maybe it's just easier to get out. At the same time, I can certainly understand why a person would not want to subject themselves to the pain that's certainly coming. But at the same time, Trump has not done that well in his effort to primary people in the past, and his popularity is really low right now, and chances are it may not be any higher by the time we get to primary season. So I'm not so sure I buy this idea that she would not be able to withstand a primary challenge. I mean, you're talking about someone who has, I think, next to Trump, probably one of the largest microphones in the country on the conservative side of politics. And to just simply walk away from that after having invested, as she openly admitted, so much personal capital to gain that kind of power and that kind of voice, me seems just kind of odd and slightly suspicious. Maybe she has plans to run for higher office. That's possible. That would make sense. Maybe she has plans to work in the media capacity somehow, start her own media channel, have a podcast. I mean, we do know that Trump is actually more influenced by people in the media than he is people that are actually serving as elected officials. So there is an avenue for her to continue to be an advocate for the conservative causes that she champions. I can't help but see it as a loss for the Republican Party. I mean, they're losing one of their strongest voices that was actually in the House as an elected official that will now be outside as probably more of a troublemaker than anything else. So not that they ever could control anything she was doing, but they certainly won't have the opportunity to do it now. And I see it as somewhat of a win for the Democrats to have that single voice taken out of an elected position where they can't vote against things that Democrats are trying to get passed. But overall, I think there's a really good chance that she'll just be forgotten in time, and it'll just kind of go down in history as another voice that was there that is just kind of fades away. I just don't really quite know what to think of this and where it's going to all end up, but it is interesting to contemplate.
Well, she did say she's not running for president, which is a really, really good thing. Look, the Republican Party has a problem with women, period. If they could get rid of all the women that are in Congress right now and replace them with white men, they'd be much happier, as we all know. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, I think, woke up a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit, to see what the shutdown meant for her constituents. The shutdown impacts red states more than it impacts blue states, because more people in the red states are on federal benefits like, you know, food stamps and all of that, than there are in the blue states, despite the rhetoric of the Republican Party and the targeting of the welfare mom as always a woman of color. So, you know, I think she may end up running for governor or running for the state house or something like that, where she's not going to be a target like she has been for Trump now. It's amazing to me how easy it is for Trump to just throw people to the side and, you know, you disagree with me. I mean, that's the issue. You disagree with me, you're done. There's nothing to, there's no reason to talk, no conversation, no nothing. You disagree with me, you're done, and that's the end of it. And so, you know, I think we'll hear from her again. Whether she'll have the kind of power, you know, who knows? Whether they have anything over her, I mean, other than, you know, stealing money, right, from the federal government. Everybody knows about her personal life, and it, you know, it's not
great. I was
going
to say, I don't know what you could come up with that would be damaging at this point to her.
Right, and she was able to get reelected anyway.
Yeah.
And Lauren Boebert as well, and her personal whatevers. So, I don't think we should say that, oh, we're missing a woman's voice now, because she was not a voice for women. Let's be honest. She was anti-choice. She was incredibly transphobic as well as homophobic. She was anti-Semitic. You know, I have a little button about the Jewish space lasers, right? You know, all of that. And so she was not a voice for women. She was a woman who had a voice. But that's two distinctly different things. And the Republican Party does not care about women. I've said this before and I'll say it again. They're okay with women bleeding out in the parking lots. And that's what's happening. And they're okay with kids dying of measles in this country. And that's what's happening. And they're okay with people getting cancer, like Tatiana Schlossberg, because they have cut the funding, right? And they're okay with that, too.
That was Libby Post on the Roundtable panel on Monday, November 24th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Tuesday, November 25th, Joe was joined by Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Information and Computer Sciences and Faculty Associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman, Joseph Palamountain Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, The Empire Report's J.P. Miller, and former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain.
Let's go, and we'll start the day. We welcome you as always. So, well, you know, yesterday the Justice Department learned that their cases against James Comey and Letitia James have been dropped. A federal judge dismissed the criminal cases against the former FBI director and the New York State general. These were separate cases, of course, delivering an emphatic blow to President Donald Trump's rushed efforts to engineer prosecutions of two of his prominent foes. Now, U.S. District Judge Cameron McGowan Curry ruled that Lindsey Halligan, the prosecutor overseeing both cases, had been unlawfully appointed as interim U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, and therefore indictments she single-handedly secured against Comey and James must be thrown out. Attorney General Pam Bondi vowed that the department would pursue all available legal action, including an immediate appeal. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt dismissed Curry as another partisan judge who, she said, had taken unprecedented steps to try to intervene in accountability. The judge said the Justice Department could seek a new indictment against James under a lawfully appointed prosecutor. In Comey's case, though, Curry suggested that the time for doing so has run out. Comey's lawyers had argued that he cannot be recharged now because the five-year deadline to bring a case against him expired days after he was indicted in September. Curry appeared to endorse that view in her written opinion Monday. She cited rulings by other courts that have held that if an indictment is invalid at the time it is issued, it does not pause the clock on the statute of limitations. All actions flowing from Ms. Halligan's defective appointment, including securing and signing Mr. Comey's indictment, constitute unlawful exercises of executive power and must be set aside, the judge wrote. Ouch. There is simply no alternative course to cure this unconstitutional problem. Her decision delivered rebukes to the Justice Department on two fronts. By declaring Halligan's appointment invalid, Curry joined several other judges who have rejected the legal arguments the Trump administration had relied upon to install loyalists in top prosecutorial positions across the country. That, once again, from the Washington Post. Bo?
Joe, there's a lot of places we could start here. I think I'll start from a factual perspective and then offer a couple of different
oh, good.
Position.
Then get to the lying.
Right.
Great. Excellent.
Yeah, get to my lying. So 120 days, the legislature, Congress has passed the law that allows presidents to have interim U.S. attorneys for 120 days. And then, of course, the judge, the district court judge, appoints and continues. That 120-day period elapsed when Eric Siebert, the previous U.S. district attorney, left the position. And so the question for Judge Curry was whether or not President Trump and the attorney general can endlessly put interim U.S. attorneys in. The answer is no, right? And the reality is this is a very, it's not a technical issue like Bondi would like us to think. It's a traditional checks and balances situation. The Senate has responsibility to confirm this appointment. Otherwise, you could just endlessly put loyalists in the position. That's the underlying feature here. Let's think about a couple of other things, though, that I think are problematic. One, U.S. attorneys are considered inferior officers in the appointment and nomination and confirmation part of the Constitution. They're considered inferior officers. I am deeply worried that this conservative court is going to see Trump's ability to appoint inferior officers as representing a broader understanding of that particular clause of the Constitution. Why am I deeply worried about that? Because on July 1st, 2024, the conservative majority in the court gave Trump a lot of wiggle room, a lot of expansive power in the Trump immunity case, especially when it comes to the Department of Justice. So I'm deeply worried about this case moving its way through the Supreme Court, up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court rejecting what Judge Curry has said. I'm also deeply worried about the fact that Bondi and Trump can use what they're describing as a technicality. Remember, this is a traditional separation of powers issue, but they're going to describe it, the narrative, as a technicality in order to place blame on the deep state, right? So it's another issue of the ability of the Trump administration and his loyalists to set the narrative. That narrative is going to be a narrative not only of the fact that Curry was appointed by Clinton, so she's another far-left, quote-unquote far-left judge, but also that the deep state is out to get Trump because of the fact that this is just the case was thrown out by a technicality. Letitia James is still on the hot seat because her case is not, the statute of limitations hasn't run out. Comey is less so, but I'm a little worried as this moves its way up through the appeals process that Bondi and Trump are gonna emerge a little bit victorious in some of this.
So when you say victorious, and I apologize if I missed something in what you were just describing, which was excellent, but it would be of whether the case can move forward as opposed to it actually being ruled on.
So I think that I think there are a couple things that an appeals court could say in this situation. One is that Halligan, who, by the way, right, remember as a footnote to this, I always have to put it in there, was the hench person for the Smithsonian. That's how she got her original job, was that she was going to
unwoke
the entire history, public funded history of the United States. But Joe, I think there are a couple of different ways in which an appeals court could rule that, A, Halligan was not improperly put in the position because as an inferior officer, the president has wide latitude. Now, remember, if the appeals courts and the Supreme Court are willing to reconsider things like the Voting Rights Act, they're going to reconsider things like what it means to be an inferior officer under that particular constitutional clause. If you say that an inferior officer, Trump can endlessly put U.S. attorneys in that position for 120 days at a time, which I could see the court saying, then Halligan is not improperly in place. So I think that's the case. I also think they can pause. Joe, I think they can pause the statute of limitations because technically Halligan did get the indictment before the statute of limitations came out, so we can go back to that time and say, oh, April Fool's, Comey, the statute of limitations is now over, but at the time of the indictment, it wasn't. So I think there are lots of ways in which an appeals court and a conservative Supreme Court could interpret this poorly for James Comey and Letitia James.
Mike Spain.
It's awfully fortunate to have a constitutional law expert on the panel today. Thanks, Bo. The idea that the U.S. attorney is a what was the term? Is regarded as a
inferior officer,
therefore not requiring Senate approval and to go through the vetting that they have traditionally gone through, and the Congress would not have a role in basically approving the appointments of U.S. attorneys. That's kind of frightening, and it would let a president just go, all across the country, just put in sycophants that do exactly what he or she might ask in the future. It's kind of scary. So I'm addressing you, Bo. If the court now says, that judge is wrong. Lindsey Halligan was properly installed and she had proper legal rights. Therefore, everything she did, the indictment, taking the case to the grand jury and getting an indictment of Comey and of Letitia James, that all goes back to there. And now it has to go through the courts. A very flimsy case that may get rejected once it gets into its merits, but how long do you think it's going to take for all this to play out?
I think it'll play out by the end of the term. So I think Comey can rest comfortably for about 6 months.
Yeah.
Oh, good. He could write another mystery.
Hey, can I interrupt with
absolutely
a piece of
it? Yes.
Whoa. So I'm just fascinated by what everybody is saying, and I'm so grateful that we have experts on the show today about this. But I have to say, as an expert in something completely different, I'm just sort of excited to see this, our beleaguered and imperfect system, fighting back. I mean, apparently we've redefined partisan as people who uphold the law, but okay. But, the system's kind of punching back at this random and destructive behavior. So, you know, I just have three words for this. Way to go. You know, I do think that, you know, there's all these sort of terrible things that can happen. But today, we should feel good that this happened because it was the right thing to do.
J.P. Miller.
Bo, you've done a great job enlightening us all. Tell me, do you think, all right, so let's assume that the Supreme Court says Halligan was properly installed. Do you see these cases going to court, or do you see maybe one that's likely to go to trial and one that's maybe not likely to go to trial?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I can't imagine, JP, that they wouldn't go to trial, that both of them wouldn't just follow the same path. I mean, part of Trump's modus operandi is public embarrassment of his enemies. So the more public a trial is, the better off he is.
Yep. And what do you think? What do you think about them being found guilty? Possible.
Zero. Oh, well, not zero, but very low.
Very low.
I mean, there is a reason why Eric Siebert jumped ship and said that there's no there with Comey.
And he was a Trump appointment.
He was a Trump appointment.
And he saw nothing there and was pushed out because he wouldn't bring these indictments.
Right.
So when you are when you think about this, it's obviously no surprise that it's going to be appealed. But do they, and I don't know exactly how this can or does work, but do they also try to find someone else other than Halligan to?
Yes. I mean, they need to, there has to be a U.S. attorney in there. So the
right.
You've got to find someone else.
They're saying she wasn't, well, they're saying that she wasn't, that she wasn't like presented correctly, right? Or are they saying that she doesn't have the credentials to actually do it?
No. So what Judge Curry is saying, there are a couple of things that are super interesting here. And before I list those off, Fran, you're absolutely right. I did a jig when Curry came out with her opinion yesterday. I thought it was a real slap in the face.
That's when I wish we worked in television. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
So I think I think there are a couple of things that are super interesting here. If you look at the appointment letter from Bondi for Lindsey Halligan, she has a workaround. Bondi has a workaround, right? She appoints Halligan as U.S. attorney, but in the event that there's something technically wrong with that appointment, she also, in that same appointment letter, Bondi also appoints her as special attorney, right? So read between the lines. Bondi absolutely understood that she could, that this appointment could run afoul of the law. So otherwise, she would not have included the additional way in which you can make Lindsey Halligan bring the indictment against Comey and so on. So, Joe, there's going to be someone in there. One of the problems that Halligan faced was that she went in to seek the indictment alone, and she had no prosecutorial experience. And so there
can
is...
Can you explain a little bit more about that? Because that was the part... I mean, usually there's a lead prosecutor, but apparently it's a message if there's only one prosecutor. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
I'm happy to talk a little bit about that. I will always tell my listeners that I am not a lawyer, though I apparently play one on WAMC's roundtable.
Unless there are other lawyers around,
right,
then
exactly.
You have to keep it in check.
That I have to defer. I'm just a constitutional guy. That said, Fran, so it is highly unusual for only a single prosecutor, especially one who's been on the job for 2 days, to be seeking the indictment because it's complicated. And there are other elements that the government wants to make as part of the equation. Here we are. Remember, there's that other case, that other technical problem that Halligan faced, which was alerted to by the judge 2 weeks ago, that She sought the change in the indictment by only going to the foreman of the grand jury. So she's making mistakes left and right. This is, and lots of people will argue, including Comey, that she is, she's not qualified for the gig, right? That said, it's still an appointment by the president. So all of these things have contributed to Comey's defense. Some are more valuable than others. Curry's 120-day the opinion that says she only has that the 120 days has elapsed. That's the most constitutionally concrete way to get her off the case.
Oh, super interesting. Thank you. Yeah, it seemed to me that, I mean, the fact that we were just looking at law and procedure done inappropriately and incorrectly, and kind of standing that up to say, look, we've got this system. It's pretty imperfect. It's pretty beleaguered. It's often biased. It's still the system we've got. And to use that system to actually make some progress, well, in my opinion, progress. I don't know. For me, that gave me a little smile, maybe a big smile.
But will she continue to be U.S. attorney?
At this point, the answer is no, JP. I mean, she can't stay on because she's...
She can't stay on.
She cannot stay on.
So the judge yesterday essentially declared her appointment as invalid and essentially said she's not the U.S. attorney.
Okay, but so they're going to then appoint another invalid U.S. attorney
So this is the thing. Yes. The 120 days is over. If we assume that it's over, and Pam Bondi knows that that was a potential problem for her, the U.S. District Court judge is the appointer. It's not the Attorney General anymore if the 120 days is over. Now, typically, this is not unusual. 120 days elapses. The U.S. District Court judge is typically going to just reappoint the person that the president
wants. I thought
that
that's what usually happens, right?
Yes.
Is this what John Sarcone in the Northern District of New York ran into?
Yes.
Same thing.
Yes.
But somehow Sarcone's still there. So you're saying that he's there illegally as well?
That's the question, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think so. The answer, I'll say this, JP. Three other places around the country you've had the judge throw out the U.S. district attorney because of this problem. I think Sarcone has that problem, but at the end of the day, that case hasn't come up before. So it's not unprecedented. What makes Lindsey Halligan interesting from a public perspective is they're going after Comey and Letitia James, right? Some of these other ones, they're not going after high-profile people. But this is happening around the country because the Trump administration and Pam Bondi want to bypass congressional rule, the 120-day rule, to keep their loyalists in office.
So the reason she was appointed improperly is because of who she prosecuted, not because of the process by which she was appointed.
No, what makes her, whatever she has done, according to Judge Curry, illegal is because the process was not followed. It's just high profile in the press because it's Comey and Letitia James.
Yeah, it should be noted, too, that Sarcone, the U.S. attorney designee in Albany, who sits in Albany, Letitia James is trying to have his position invalidated also because he's been investigating her also. So, I mean, it gets into the whole, and I don't want to use the word technicality, it gets into the whole way that the courts look at the way that this has been going on for centuries?
Fact of the matter, as long as we've had U.S. attorneys, you've had to follow the process, the traditional checks and balances process, which is nomination by the president, confirmed by the Senate. And if you want to bypass the confirmation by the Senate, Congress has said, okay, we want to keep the wheels of justice going. You can have 120 days to put your person in. But after that, no, Congress needs to review these appointments. That's the Madisonian checks and balances at work. And that's been going on since 1787 or 1789 when we had the ratification.
That was Beau Breslin on the Roundtable panel on Tuesday, November 25th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Wednesday, November 26th, Joe was joined by former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, Mayor of the City of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, and Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, Catherine Tan.
Let's get to what is going on in the news. A couple things I want to talk. Obviously, we'll talk about Russia in a moment, and because the we talked a lot about this over the last couple of days, and we spoke about it yesterday. Not a lot has changed, so we'll address it, but we'll take a moment before we do it. I would like to talk about the CDC because this is a story that we haven't covered in a while, and I think it's important that we do. Dr. Ralph Abraham was promoted and is now second in command of the Centers for Disease Control. During the COVID pandemic, Ralph Lee Abraham promoted discredited treatments like ivermectin, and as Louisiana Surgeon General halted the state's mass vaccination plan. So now, he has been named the second in command at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Department of Health and Human Services did not announce the appointment, and many CDC employees seemed unaware of it. But the CDC's internal database lists Dr. Abraham as the agency's principal deputy director with a start date of November 23rd, which was, of course, 3 days ago. The appointment was first reported by the Substack column Inside Medicine. A spokesman for HHS confirmed Dr. Abraham's new position but declined to comment further. Dr. Abraham did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Dr. Abraham's views on some issues align with those of Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He has endorsed avoiding Tylenol in pregnancy except when absolutely necessary because of a possible link to autism. He's also backed ending routine immunization for hepatitis B at birth and removing from vaccine ingredients like aluminum salts, which are added to enhance the immune response. Catherine Tan, this is up your alley. What do you think?
To reiterate some of the points you just made, Abraham is a pretty problematic physician to be placed second in command at the CDC. He is an anti-vaxxer. He supported hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin as COVID treatments, even though there's no evidence supporting those things. He also endorsed avoiding Tylenol, which was, you know, in the news a few months ago. So a lot of his medical beliefs do not align with what experts know and what research has shown. So it's really problematic that we have someone who is essentially a quack in charge of the CDC or having so much authority at the CDC. For me, the larger existential issue is what this is going to do to public trust in the CDC and other agencies under the Department of Health and Human Services. We're going to see some pretty far-reaching repercussions when you start filling these important seats with quacks and people who do not believe in the science that they're supposed to speak to and represent. So I'm especially concerned about what this is going to do to public trust in these agencies. Right now, I'm working on a research project with a former student who is now my co-investigator, and we're looking at Lyme disease prevention and specifically how researchers respond to public distrust, how they vaccine controversies of the past continue to shape the research that they're doing today. And recently, we were talking to people, public health workers at the CDC, and one of the concerns that our participant expressed is, you know, there are a lot of good researchers throughout this agency, right? These are people who are committed to public health and improving the lives of Americans and creating opportunities for people to stay healthy. And so their concern is, with all of these, these anti-science, anti-medicine people filling these important positions, what is this going to do to their agency? Like, people are not going to know who to turn to for reliable information, and that is a huge problem, right? So these agencies are supposed to be sources of reliable medical health information, but they are being corrupted, and they really aren't reliable anymore. Just a few weeks ago, or maybe not a few weeks ago, maybe this is last week. My sense of time is not great. But recently, the CDC changed the language about vaccines, casting doubt on whether or not vaccines are safe and whether or not they are linked to neurodevelopmental conditions. And vaccines are safe, right? The studies show that they are safe and they do not cause autism. They do not cause developmental disabilities. But the fact that they changed that language on the CDC website is really concerning, because this is what people are going to refer to for reliable information. So a lot of, the researchers that we have talked to in public health are really concerned, because, if you have some of the CDC's website spouting misinformation, but then you also have a lot of important reliable information on the website as well, like, how is the public supposed to differentiate what they can trust and what they, should be wary of? And where else would they go if this, if this information has, or if these, if this website and the information they put out have been compromised? So that's, I think that's the larger issue here. And of course, even larger than that is, like, this is going to result in people getting sick, people dying, right? So Abraham, when he was, leading the health department in Louisiana, there was a whooping cough outbreak, and he waited 2 months before warning the public. And in that time, like, two babies died, right? Mm-hmm. So there are real consequences to these things.
You know, I think that, to me, the other piece of this is, and again, we have an administration that is looking to deceive and distract.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have all of these decades of science being turned on its head, mm-hmm. that show that vaccines are safe and that have given really good, I think, health advice to parents and to doctors about how to keep their children healthy. And we're looking to undermine that,
mm-hmm.
and make parents doubt whether or not they should get a vaccine. At the same time, we have an EPA and an environmental policy that is saying we're not going to restrict fine particulates, which we know, mm-hmm. can cause heart disease and lung cancer. We are not going to put these restrictions on PFAS, these forever chemicals. We're going to allow you to burn coal. We're going to take away a lot of the things that we've created in order to prevent us from being exposed to chemicals that can have a neurotoxic effect on us, that may actually be the reason that we're seeing an increase in autism diagnoses, mm-hmm. across the population, mm-hmm. that may be the reason that we have people, young people, experiencing higher cancer rates of certain types of cancer. Mm-hmm. And so rather than making us healthy again, it is really, for me, the audacity and the pulling the wool over average Americans' eyes and undermining trust in science, at the same time that we're saying, but we're not going to look over here,
right,
at the things that most of us are afraid of. Most of us are concerned about exposures to chemicals for our kids. What should we be feeding our kids? Mm-hmm. The types of preservatives that are in our food. All of these things. We're going to deregulate that, and we're going to convince people not to vaccinate their kids.
Yeah. And
it's horrifying.
And the things that you're listing, the the different toxic exposures that are out there, things that need regulation, are not things that people have individual control over, right? So all of these exposures are it's really up to like the government to regulate. And, you know, you're telling people, well, it's your choice if you want to vaccinate your kids. It's your choice if you take Tylenol. And a lot of the language that we're hearing from these different prescriptions coming from the CDC recently place responsibilities on individual Americans, right? But these are, at the same time, as you point out, at the same time, they are pushing misinformation. So people don't know, you know, with all the doubts and fear that is sown, like people don't know what to do. And it's such a vicious, I don't know, it's such a vicious thing to do to American people. Meanwhile, as you pointed out, that's really important. Like all these other things impact our health, but we have zero control over it.
I want to go back. I agree 100%. This is a real concern that we're moving away from scientifically based vaccination mm-hmm. policies. But I think what is getting lost a little bit in the vaccination focus is the broader focus of Dr. Abraham's long experience in the medical profession. Actually, he was a veterinarian for a decade before he was a doctor. He has an MD, but is not board certified as a family physician. Mm-hmm. His professional experience is as a radiologist, even though he has done some family practice. He is not board certified as a family practitioner. And after 3 years in three terms in Congress, Louisiana created the Surgeon General title and appointed Abraham to that first role after leaving Congress as a co-leader of the Department of Health in Louisiana at a time when Louisiana then virtually banned almost all abortions mm-hmm. and then moved legislation to label abortion drugs like mifepristone as a controlled substance in order to criminalize the distribution of abortion drugs outside of what the state had allowed in its near total ban of abortion. And the elevation or the movement of Abraham from Louisiana in those roles up through the CDC, I think has a bigger, more broadly reaching impact. It is vaccines. He is clearly a vaccine denier, whatever mm-hmm. that, like, I don't even know how those critic words go together. a critic or like, you know, as somebody who is not an expert in vaccines, he says things that non-experts might say about vaccines, but he does it on a public platform. But he is pushing also an agenda that is anti-abortion and that could move the CDC closer mm-hmm. to reclassifying abortion provisions, along with other kinds of healthcare that have been tested and proven safe for decades for people. I'm thinking hormone replacement treatment mm-hmm. for people who are transgender, right? We're seeing this crisis of leadership in the CDC that I do think is going to have widespread ramifications.
Mm-hmm. And also just how this will impact the way people perceive physicians, right? So not just their perceptions of the agency, but how they perceive the medical profession as a whole.
Politicizing medicine at a level that we haven't seen, mm-hmm. I've never seen.
We are talking about a doctor critical of vaccines quietly being appointed as the CDC's second in command. We've heard from most of our panel. We'll go to Judy Patrick now. I just one thing that does strike me about this, and all of our panelists so far have talked about the great concerns here, but if you were proud of it, you wouldn't be quietly doing it.
Yeah, that's one of the things that interests me a lot is the fact that this was revealed via a Substack column that and was not part of an official press release. And in fact, a lot of what's happening at the CDC is an insidious attack on science and on vaccine at a time when, if you remember, RFK Jr. came before the Senate and promised he was not anti-vax. He
would not going to do anything.
I'm not going to do anything like that. If you go to the CDC has a site, has a piece of its site that says where you can go and look and where to find a vaccine nearest you. If you go there, it's disabled. It doesn't work. They never announced that they were going to do that, but it's the subtle nature. And the medical societies, the American Academy of Pediatricians, the American Medical Society, they are doing their best to try to be the leaders, to put solid, reliable medical information out there about vaccines. But in addition to the insidious nature of the messages getting out to the American public, you have the overt messages. I mean, there are so many people in my life who blame their heart attack, blame the latest sniffle on their COVID shot, on their flu shot. And again, as someone who grew up, so thankful. My parents were so thankful for that polio vaccine.
Oh, I know.
Oh, yeah. Man. I'll take any vaccine headed my way. But we need to do a better job of educating Americans about who to rely on. Sometimes it's the medical professionals, someone with a little bit of medical information who maybe you took biology in college, who will go on and say, well, the research says aluminum in the vaccines will give you, some sort of disease. Or the babies nowadays are getting too many vaccines. You're hearing this so often on social media that. And instead of the CDC being out there and correcting that information, they are subtly and sometimes overtly encouraging that kind of skepticism.
I mean, I think one piece of it is definitely educating the public, but that alone is not enough. And now, of course, that is completely compromised because you're getting all of these mixed messages and officials are casting doubt on medical information. But in addition to that, because something like vaccines, it is not, as we discussed while we were at commercial break, it's not really, it feels like an individual's choice. It's something that's talked about like it's an individual choice, but this is a decision that you're making not for just for yourself, but for the people around you, for your community, right? Especially when it's an infectious disease, it's your responsibility. And so I think this is where state policies matter a lot. The kinds of policies that we have in place to ensure that people do get vaccinated. So, I'm thinking about the policies that we have for school children needing to be fully vaccinated before, entering public school. Like, right. We need policies like that to ensure that people actually get the health care that they need. And it's, these are social contracts that we have with each other, right? It's really for politicians like RFK Jr. to say these are personal choices, it's a lie. These are not personal choices that you can make for just yourself or just for your child.
That was Catherine Tan on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, November 26. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.